You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. G.W. Winnicott described it as, quote, the fog over the battlefield. It's called melancholia, the blues, the black dog, the brown study, the blue devil, the dismals. It's called depression. And as writer Daphne Merkin tells us in her beautiful new memoir, This Close to Happy, it's a global problem affecting 350 million people worldwide. And yet, she points out, quote, this is a sadness that no one seems to want to talk about in public. Well, tonight at the Los Angeles Public Library, let's talk about depression. Daphne Merkin's fearless and informative memoir has already been hailed as a classic, taking its place in the canon alongside Andrew Solomon's The Noonday Demon, William Styron's Darkness Visible, and Kay Redfield Jameson's An Unquiet Mind. Merkin's account of living with clinical depression is deeply intimate, blending the personal with research, fusing intellectual rigor and raw emotional honesty. It's a mesmerizing read, recommended for those in the mental health professions, those who care about the suffering of their loved ones, those who suffer from this affliction themselves, and as well, all those who appreciate beautifully written memoirs. Born to German-Jewish emigres in New York, Merkin grew up in an affluent family on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. She struggled with depression since childhood. Material wealth, she makes clear, was no shield against this psychological affliction. Merkin is a former staff writer for The New Yorker, and her writing frequently appears in The New York Times, Book Forum, and many other publications. Her previous books include Enchantment, which won the Edward Lewis Wallant Award, and two collections of essays, Dreaming of Hitler and The Fame Lunches. And she's here today joining us from her home in New York City. And joining Daphne tonight on the stage is Jill Soloway, the Emmy Award-winning creator of Amazon Studios' Transparent, a series breaking all kinds of aesthetic and social boundaries. Jill's production company is called Topple, as in Topple the Patriarchy. I love that. She won the U.S. Dramatic Directing Award at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival for her first feature, Afternoon Delight. She's a three-time Emmy nominee for her work writing and producing one of my favorite all-time series, 6 Feet Under. Please join me in welcoming Daphne Merkin and Jill Soloway to the stage.
Very exciting. I can pretend I'm hosting a talk show. My dream come true. This is actually my dream come true because I've been such a huge fan of Daphne's really since, I don't know, 20 years ago. I remember reading your work and feeling very much inspired to write myself and very much like I could become myself because you existed. So I'm just thrilled.
Thank you.
I'm so excited. And we're going to start by having you read something.
Okay. I was just going to read a tiny little bit from the book, nothing long, just from the opening and from the very end. This is from the prologue. Lately, I've been thinking about the allure of suicide again, the way it says basta to life, like an Italian grandmother sweeping out all the accumulated debris of daily existence, leaving a clean and unmarked surface. No more rage at the circumstances that have brought you down. No more dread. No more going from day to day in a state of suspended animation, feeling tired around the eyes, behind them too, and making conversation, hoping no one can tell what's going on inside. No more anguish, that roaring pain inside your head that feels physical but has no somatic correlation that can be addressed and treated with a Band-Aid or ointment or cast. Most of all, no more disguise, no more need to wear a mask. What, you depressed? I never would have known. They come on such suicidally colored periods at times like these. I am writing this in the winter at my desk in New York City when the days are short, evening starts early, the sky lacks light, and you have ceased admiring your own efforts to keep going. Although they can also come on when the day is long and the light never fading, in early spring or ripest summer. They come on because your mood, which has been sliding perceptibly downward for weeks, even months, has hit rock bottom. You lie there in the sludge, no longer bothering to flail around, marooned in a misery that is no less easy to bear because there is nothing wildly terrible to point to in the circumstances of your own life, on the surface at least, to account for it. And now this fatal tug has made itself felt again, suggesting an end to your despondency, your inability to get with the program, a phrase you've never liked in its brisk gym coach approach to what is, after all, a complex situation, this matter of your life and how much you want to submit to its terms, but all the same an apt one. You have never understood the program, to be sure, what it is that you are meant to be propelling yourself toward, what long-term goal hovers before you that would suggest the possibility of a successful completion. There is, of course, the matter of your writing, a goal of a sort, but also the impulse that keeps you going most reliably. Art is supposed to be long and life short, or so the Latin saying has it, ars longa vita brevis. But on a day like today, when everything seems gray and thin, nothing gives you ballast. You are too worn down to even to pretend to know why you should put one foot after the other. It is life that seems too long, endless. A clock ticks somewhere in the silence of your apartment, empty second after empty second, reminding you that time hangs heavy when you have lost your way, like a vise around your neck. You are reminded as well of one of your stays on a psychiatric unit, when you sat in the so-called day room with some of the other patients and watched TV in the middle of the afternoon, something you would never have done at home, and which made you feel entirely useless, like a piece of clothing hung out to dry and then forgotten about. However did you fill your days before this torpor came and claimed you? It is difficult to recall how you once went naturally from one activity to the next, writing and reading, indulging in virtual window shopping on the computer, talking to your daughter, laughing over something with a friend, warming up a cup of coffee or tea in the microwave. It wasn't as though you were ever exactly a dervish of energy, spinning from one hectically scheduled event to the next. You are a stay-at-home sort at the best of times, someone who is to assemble the internal wherewithal to go out and meet people, no matter how open and receptive you seem. But before, you didn't question the whole ongoing shebang of making plans. Now you can no longer figure out what it is that moves other people to bustle about out there in the world, doing errands, rushing to appointments, picking up a child from school. You have lost the thread that pulled the circumstances of your life together. Nothing adds up, and all you can think about is the raw nerve of pain that your mind has become. And once again, how merciful it would be to yourself and others to extinguish this pain. You might have become an addict under different circumstances, retreating into the nullifying bliss of street drugs. Instead, you take a prescribed regimen of legal drugs, tweaked occasionally by a well-meaning psychopharmacologist, and articulate your condition in 50-minute sessions to people to whom you have paid large sums of money to listen to you over the years. You sit in their offices and discuss your wish to die the way other patients discuss their wish to find a lover. Never mind your daughter, your friends, your writing, the taste of something delicious, a new book, or the TV series everyone is watching, the things that are supposed to moor you to this world. Even those you know who know you best don't understand the glare bouncing off your eyes, the glare that prevents you from seeing up the road. Despair is always described as dull, when the truth is that despair has a light all its own, a lunar glow, the color of mottled silver. Should I read the end? We'll let it go.
Maybe we should talk a little, and then you can read, and then we can talk some more. Wow, that was so beautiful. I mean, your writing is just, it's amazing, I think. What made you decide to use the you?
Right.
To speak as you in that piece instead of I.
I'm not sure. It seemed I think sometimes when I wanted, was that, first of all, I wrote the book, as you know, over many years, and I wasn't always in the same mood writing it. So I think sometimes I wanted a little more distance between the me and the protagonist of the book, who is me. But it felt pretty much organic going from you to I.
Yeah, because it felt like you were speaking to me. Like, I think everybody, I could feel everybody feeling that the you was themselves.
Right.
There are so many things about pulling together the, losing the thread and pulling together the circumstances and how other people seem to stack up. They're going here, they're going there, they're going to go to dinner, they're going to go to the thing. But for you, like, I feel like a lot of people feel that way. Like, what? How in the world am I going to go out tonight, and why would I go to this thing?
Right.
I mean, tonight was great because we were going to do this.
Right.
How do you differentiate the sort of constant common dread that most people feel about why everything matters and the real disease of depression?
Right. I think that's a good question, because I think one of the problems with depression is that it's, with like severe depression, is that it's both, it seems mysterious and familiar. I mean, it's not, for instance, schizophrenia. I mean, you're not walking around saying, I just conversed with a Martian from another planet. You know, Martian is from another planet. So
usually they're from Mars.
Usually.
Often.
Sometimes
they are from
Switzerland.
Mars. Sometimes Switzerland.
So I think I was talking with someone why depression seems to me to still be stigmatized. And I think it's partly because it seems, it's an odd word to use, there's something contagious seeming about it. Like someone said to me, I quote her in the book, it was actually Diane Keaton said it to me when I did a profile of her. She said to me, everyone's a little depressed. I mean, most people who think and are conscious, I mean, I always think, a little depression is humanizing. It would humanize Donald Trump, for instance, to suffer from some depression. But I think the distinction between sort of everyday dread, as you said, and clinical depression is a big one in terms of, I mean, you can have dread and essentially function. I think when you're, when I was terribly depressed and it was referred to as a, when I went into the hospital the last time I went in some years, about 8-9 years ago, I was supposed to have, one of the things that was suggested was ECT, which I reared back from doing. Not that I don't think it has helped very many people. And the doctor who wanted me to have it was particularly graceless. And she said to me, you know, you're in a vegetative depression. It's called vegetative when you, well, it's actually the term that's used. When I didn't, I didn't eat, I didn't talk much. I seemed to have slept most of the day away. And she said, you know, you'll never write again. And that was her argument for ECT. But I'm saying that kind of depression presents with enormous dysfunction.
So do you have a sense in your life, in your day-to-day, when you're trying to sort of keep an eye out for it and make sure that you're keeping it at bay? And is that what this is? Is this depression? Is this an episode coming on? Am I in it? Do you feel like part of it, part of what differentiates depression from a horrible mood or being filled with dread or just being depressed is that when you're in it, you can't assess it?
You mean in the depression?
Yeah, like
right.
You're not able to look at it and name it and say, come on, we're going to go out.
We're going to go out. That kind of self-coaxing doesn't work so well anymore. I mean, you can coax yourself forward out of bad moods.
Mm-hmm.
I always have this literal sense that something shifts, like in the shadow falls over things when it's happened. But I think, as I sort of say at the end of the book, which is a little more hopeful than the beginning of the book, that you kind of learn to navigate around depression, to sort of sense that it might... I mean, I think there are things to put in place that help. I mean, including I am on, as I write in the book, I have a very, I was going to say I have an ambivalent relationship with everything, but I have an ambivalent relationship with medication, which I've been on for years, since my 20s. And it has certainly helped, but it has its many, some side effects. Not all the side effects that they would cite on TV for every drug, but many side effects. And last summer, I tried to go off medication. I'm not sure it was handled very well, but I utterly plunged. So to some degree, I credit them with a certain amount of keeping the balance.
That's good. Well, I guess we should get right to the good stuff, which is that when Daphne and I were emailing with each other, we were sort of like, all the things we love to talk about, like sex and Jews and the Holocaust and shame. So for those of you who came for sex, Jews, Holocaust, shame, it's time. Where would we start? Those four are all so good. Maybe with shame. Which is sort of sex, Jews, Holocaust sandwich. Shame would be like the bread, or what do you feel like is the relationship between shame and depression?
It's something I've strangely thought about very belatedly. I think it is enormous because I think the same messages the culture gives out about depression, which is to some degree, I think, even though there's greater understanding of it and people discuss their medications, they don't discuss the existential condition. There's some sense of, you know, get out of it, pull yourself together. Like, what are you doing malingering when you should be? So I think it comes with a lot of shame.
Do you ever think about who you would be chemically if you were born to a family where your parents weren't
the charming parents they were?
Yeah, dealing with all of the sort of post-Holocaust, I guess self-hatred or hate or withholdingness. Like, yeah.
You mean if there had been a different set of parents?
Yeah, maybe if you were adopted into like a nice Goyish family. And
I
got to celebrate Christmas. And you were, you know, just cuddled and coddled and given a pony and put on sports teams.
Right. Hard to fathom, but I have thought a lot about what it's like to not grow up with the Holocaust as a set piece.
What would that be like?
A relief.
Yeah.
I keep thinking it would be lighter. You wouldn't, I mean, in my particular family, my parents were both German Jews who left Germany in the 30s and lost a lot of close relatives. And my mother had, I don't know whether to say it, she had a sort of fascination with, I think she had a fascination with the sort of, sounds odd to say with Nazism, but she did. I mean, when she had herself been a writer before she married my father.
Yes, and she published a book, right?
Later. And she wrote a story called To Be One of Them, based on her own experience before she left Germany at 16. She went to a Hitler rally. And it's about a young Jewish girl getting caught up in the drama, excitement, maybe sadistic excitement of the Nazi rally. Mm-hmm. And it was a big sort of theme in my family. Mm. Like, I think I went away to summer camp, and although I should have loved being away, I didn't. And I would write these unhappy letters, and my mother wrote back, you know, you could think of concentration camp as the standard, which didn't help at all. Right. But it would have been very different.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That was one of the interesting things about the book, is that I kept feeling like your mother was sort of this abusive lover, and it was so obvious, yet you were so devoted to her. And so can you talk a little bit about that? You know, clearly you were aware that there are other people who would say, oh, I'm going to cut off contact with this person. I'm not going to talk to them anymore.
Right.
I'm going to just cut this person out of my life.
First of all, I think it's easier to do if you have other choices. If there is a father you feel close to, mm-hmm. or in my family there was a particularly abusive, I mean, we certainly didn't refer to her as nanny, but she was a caretaker who I was terrified of, and she was physically abusive and very cold. So my mother was the only show in town for me. And she was also, I guess today one would say she had charisma. She wasn't only negative, but she had a very, very destructive side, which took me, I was going to say, I'm not sure to this day, there was something about her I couldn't figure out. She was mercurial. She was very smart. I would sometimes read stuff I wrote to her and say, do you like this word or do you like this word? She'd patiently say, no, I think sweet is better than whatever word I was asking. Mm. But I had enormous trouble extricating myself from her. And I think that kind of set a pattern for where we were talking a little bit earlier about abjection.
Mm-hmm.
The whole way of being involved with another person emotionally, that somehow it seemed, she did seem to have all the cards.
Mm. And so do you feel like that masochism is an attempt to, that in particular she gave you the sort of roadmap for a masochistic life?
I do. I mean, I think she gave a roadmap that if you hung around enough a withholding person, a little glint of warmth would come out. And then it seemed better than the warmth that came readily from a naturally more giving person. And I think it did set a certain pattern.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of an alive dynamic.
Yeah.
And do you feel like, I think about your marriage as somebody who you married a decent man.
Yes.
A good man. But maybe somebody who didn't have that alive dynamic with you.
Right. I think I once wanted to write a novel called Bad Taste. Or what the psychiatrist called object choice, you know, who you pick. I think I naturally, my tendency would be to pick someone in some sense not good for me, that would excite me but be out of reach. And I don't know if, I don't think that makes for, I mean, I didn't stay married in this instance in any case, but it wasn't that kind of dynamic.
Do you ever think that being able to separate out particular sexual notions like masochism or kink from your love life, from the person you're attempting to relate to, would be a good solution? Or did you ever think, I will just, separate my life into these pieces where
they're not so. I mean,
yeah, a kind of sort of.
I think in the case, in my particular case, my romantic life tended to be obsessional.
Mm-hmm.
And one way, I remember when I was on the staff of The New Yorker, I was going out with a particularly untalented, I think, mm-hmm. I wasn't his patient, he struck me as an untalented psychiatrist. And he was very envious of my writing. Mm. And I was doing a movie column. And I remember thinking, okay, I'll give up the movie column. You know, he hated that I was in print and was always pushing me to get some boring paper he wrote published. Not sure where this is going.
Well, okay, so let me ask this question.
Yeah.
How does this interface with depression? Looking for love, needing to be loved, having a certain model of love come from your mom that has a kind of masochism in it.
Right.
Are these all tied up for you?
They're less tied up now, mostly because I think I don't want to say I've abjured love totally, but I am leery of getting entangled in relationships with men where the choice seems to be me or them.
Hmm.
It seems to be all relationships with men and women to me often. But I think for depression, because I did years ago a piece on, I don't know if you remember, Hedda Nussbaum, the woman who was with Joel Steinberg. And I always thought I did a piece about their relationship called The Couple Next Door, that they had begun as a regular couple and slowly slid into this deeply S&M-ish relationship. But she always struck me as very depressed without him.
Mm.
That maybe to pull out of the depression, you need a certain amount of intensity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the fact that you're willing to think about the household where this child was killed and say, I want to go in there and feel that with them. It's amazing.
Right.
Sort of like your mom going to the Nazi rally.
True. Well, I thought one thing I would say about my mother was she wasn't particularly shockable.
Mm.
And she did have a kind of, today it would be called a transgressive imagination. She did. And I think some of that I got from her, like, well, in her case, it was sort of macabre.
Mm.
Like drawing swastikas on my arm, which to this day I don't really get what she thought she was doing.
Just wanting to see what happened, if she did that, yeah. Or share her obsession?
She did it very idly, like a daisy chain. And I don't know. A writer friend of mine suggested that it was trying to protect me in some way, but that seemed a little sweet for the scenario.
The various readings of your mother drawing a swastika on your arm. Yeah. Did she, I think about, when I asked Daphne backstage, I said, can I talk about the spanking piece? Because it's so much a thing, which is like, why are people still talking about that? But that was the piece that I read that made me it really just transformed me as a writer and as a person. Did your mom read that piece?
You know, it's odd. This was a piece I wrote in The New Yorker about erotic spanking, and it was called Unlikely Obsession. And it was, I have to say, we never discussed it.
Wow.
I assume she did read it.
You never talked about
it. No. I think I was embarrassed. Maybe she thought it was beneath discussion. I don't know.
Yeah.
She used to say to me in later years in her German accent, "You're not writing another piece about sex." She couldn't, but no, that piece had a long, still has, had a long afterlife.
Yeah.
And I still think took a kind of, as I'm about to say this, I'm thinking of a former agent of mine who said to me, "When they say you're brave, they mean you're crazy."
I don't believe that.
It took a kind of, and it was something that I thought a lot about and, you know, wanted to write about. But I do remember in its aftermath, there was, I eventually fled and visited my sister in Israel. I got as far away as possible from, because someone wrote a piece in the, I think it was the Observer, "How could I have children?"
Right.
I mean, you'd think I'd written that I flayed people alive. It was fairly limited.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, you know, you talked about this other book you wrote that you were going to publish and that you hadn't, and I'm supposed to be writing a memoir right now, and you know, at 6 or 7 or 8 in the morning, it seems like a good idea. And then by 3 or 4, I don't know why I'm doing it.
Right.
And I can't imagine why in the world I would want to share the details of my life with the public. I look at Transparent sometimes. I remember one of my parents saying to me, you know, looking at it and saying, "It's pornography, you're a pornographer." You know, joking, teasing.
Right.
But I really do find myself, you know, zealously pushing myself to say it's okay to make work about sex because you're a woman and because feminism so needs women to corroborate other women's desire in patriarchy. And in some ways, I feel that I must just sacrifice my relationship with my family and in some ways my children's opinion of me by telling the truth about what it feels like to be alive and sexual. Do you have that feminist zealot in you that says I must?
I always think of Virginia Woolf saying that sex, I don't know the exact quote, and I tried to find it recently, that until women, one doesn't associate Virginia Woolf with enormous erotic, although I think there was more, you know, to her erotically than has been granted, including even with Leonard, not to mention her homoerotic life. But she said that until women wrote openly about sex, it would all remain, you know, not, we wouldn't have gone forward enough. Mm-hmm. And I think women are intimidated easily when writing. I don't think men are as intimidated about, I mean, there's no man, in my opinion, there's no male writer who could have written a piece in The New Yorker about liking spanking or not liking spanking or whatever, and someone would say, "What kind of father is he?"
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one went after John Updike, who wrote endlessly about, you know, sort of pink labias or whatever he wrote about. I mean, I like Updike a lot. That's, I don't want to reduce him to pink labias, but people didn't say, "What kind of father is he?" Somehow women are pinned to sexual disclosure in a way that men aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a decision to sort of go there. And I was telling Jill before we went on that I about this novel that I had sold many years ago. That was fairly, very sexually graphic. And I, in the end, pulled it from being published because I kept thinking, everyone's going to associate me with this woman crawling on the floor. They won't make any distinction that this is fiction. And it somehow seemed, but as I also said to you, at this point, I don't care. And I'm going back to the novel to finish it. But I think it's hard for women to write about. I mean, someone said to me, I don't know if there's a woman who's written a memoir who hasn't been called self-indulgent at some point or other, and I don't think male memoirists are so easily called self-indulgent.
No.
There are certain things just thrown at the female.
Yeah, our femaleness, and I think about sometimes with directing when I'm casting and putting together a movie, I think about how much it's like dolls, and that so many girls grow up playing dolls, and directing and filmmaking is exactly the same. And I think about writing. It's like we all also grow up journaling. But they act like movies are something else. They act like writing is something else. That there's this kind of immature art
to the
memoir, to the confessional, which is
right.
Like, that's for teenage girls in their journals.
Right.
And yeah, I think it does have so much to do with patriarchy and men sort of wanting to hold the narrative and keeping women in the place of other. And so as we say I, or as we start the memoir, start to say I am, we're trying to take the subject position. And that necessarily puts men in the object position, which is uncomfortable.
Right.
So they sort of degrade our creativity in that way. I have like a whole pocket full of questions.
I was going to say, what happened to those cards?
Well, they're all here, but I was also thinking, like, I wanted to take the feeling of just going out for lunch with you.
Yes.
And ask you all the questions I would ask you. And I feel like if we went out to lunch, it would be weird if I pulled cards out. So I'm going to pull them out when I run out of things. But I wanted to, when you were reading, I started to think about you writing. And I imagined you at home and these words that are so... It's like I'm imagining you getting into each sentence, because each and every one of your sentences is just like this, is this dance toward an idea. And I was just curious, how do you do it? What does it feel like? What does it feel like for you to, are these straight out of your brain, or do you blah something out and then come back and get it perfect? How does this amazing?
Well, as I think I mentioned to you, this book, actually, to show you how unstraight out of my brain it is, I started, this book came about because in 2001, I wrote a piece for The New Yorker called The Black Season, about being hospitalized for depression, because I kept thinking that I didn't know that many accounts of what hospitalization felt like. And I got a lot of letters, and one letter stayed with me, which was a woman who wrote me. I was actually working on another book about symbiotic love, my usual interest. And a woman wrote me and said she wished her sister had been alive to read the piece, so she would have gone into the hospital instead of killing herself. And I got a book contract for the book, but I had enormous trouble writing it. So it wasn't, and I had went through three different book contracts. I think I felt, even though I've written about other subjects that are self-exposing, I felt there was enormous exposure in writing. I mean, there's a lot of self-hatred and depression. And I kept thinking, if I write about it, am I going to sound hateful? Is my self-hatred going to be glopped all over the pages? So there were many kind of inhibiting forces. I might add, quite factually, not least, that my mother was alive. Even though I had written in a novel that she reminded, that I thought at one point... She was, I published a novel many years ago, and in it I said, I'm beginning to think of my mother will sound, that my mother was Ilse Koch, who was the head of women's SS at Auschwitz. So it wasn't like I'd been terribly careful while my mother was alive, but to go deeply into what I saw as a family that in many ways fostered depression and the whole nature-nurture argument, I probably was helpful to me that my mother wasn't alive in the last part of this. But I basically read. I was a book editor for 6 years, and I think I read for sentences and perceptions. I mean, I know other people read for plot, which only secondarily interests me. But I do, and I began as a poet, so I sort of love that kind of putting words, making them, as you nicely said, dance or whatever. Yeah. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes I sit there and think, how come this hasn't gotten any easier? I mean, I think when you sit down to write, it often seems like you're starting, I don't know how it feels for you, when like you're starting all over again. Especially in this kind of book where I was drawing heavily, heavily on internal experience.
Right, so there isn't a plot or story to follow. Right. It's like, let's go deeper into this.
Right.
This idea, this feeling, this thought.
While trying to sort of simulate a plot to give it some propulsive motion.
It felt so cozy to read it. I did read it in bed, but I also just felt like I was, you know, sort of laying in bed next to you and hearing these kinds of ideas, and it felt just so intimate and just so beautiful. And I think that there is something about this idea, you know, I told you I'm working on this show that's an adaptation of I Love Dick, where Chris Krauss really just goes into just her awfulness. And I love, I think, in some ways, if once we've gotten over the idea of writing about sex, to be able to write about sadness and to write about it so, just to be so filled up with it.
Right.
It keeps taking you down new rivers. And to read it and to want to go down those rivers, to go on that ride with you. I mean, did you think about that in selling the book? Do you think about that now, the book being kind of seductive?
Very much. I did think about that. I had read a book some years ago. I think I and maybe one other person read this book. And it was called, I can't remember because I loaned it to someone and never got it back. If it was called 12 or 13, and it was about a family of 13 kids, and the background a little bit reminded me of mine. And I have an infinite taste for dark things and depressing things, but I read the book and I thought, unless you really wanted to become one with his depression, you wouldn't want to finish the book. So I kept that in my mind as a cautionary tale that I wanted to sort of put in space in my book for the reader to be with me but not be with me, for some humor, I hope.
It was funny for sure.
Yeah. And I think writing is seduction. So if you don't think of... I once wrote a piece, a critical essay in The New Yorker, and I said, if you didn't, I was reviewing a book called The KGB Reader. And I remember I said that in today's ADD times, if you weren't seduced, I mean, this is too draconian, if you weren't seduced by the third sentence, you would give up. But I do think you have to pull in readers incredibly and viewers incredibly quickly. I mean, these aren't sort of Dickensian, that kind of long... I know I tried last summer. I always thought of myself as a lover of Henry James. And I was horrified when I realized I found the opening of Portrait of a Lady unbearably slow. I thought, maybe I've... So that seductive thing was important.
Yeah, it's interesting to be willing to and to name seductiveness as an aspect of talking about depression. So very soon we're going to turn to you for questions, but I think I will just pull out my cards here.
Magician-like cards.
I have so many questions I want to ask. Oh, this is a good one. What about pleasure? Do you ever just think, which I do sometimes, that you could stack up pleasurable experiences to combat your depression?
Lately.
Just trying to give yourself pleasure in as long chunks as you can.
Right.
And if so, how do you do that?
You mean what are the pleasurable experiences or?
What gives you pleasure? Can you deliver it to yourself, sort of like a good mommy?
Right.
And just begin to just brick by brick, hour by hour, attend to your body and your pleasure in a way that can almost reparent. Does that ever seem like a good?
Seems like a great idea. I'm sounding a little null and void on the pleasure front.
Like for me, work is pleasurable. I love writing and I love being in the land of the Pfeffermans, but it creates a kind of strange feeling of prostitution because it makes money.
Right. Well, in my case, there's no such worry. I love being absorbed.
Mm.
That, I would say, is probably my notion of pleasure, that I am lost to my own. So one way, except for when we're fighting furiously, I can spend time with my daughter and feel this is sort of being absorbed. You know, I'm sort of fascinated by her. And reading still remains an incredible pleasure for me. That's one of the worst things for me about being very depressed, is I don't read.
Oh, really? You don't pick up a book or anything?
It, like, stops that whole... I was going to say a little less fortunately eating.
A delicious meal.
Yes.
When you're out and about and socializing with friends, do you have that observing voice saying, what are you doing here? I don't want to be here. I want to go home. Or are you able to be in socializing?
I think if I like the people enough, I can be in socializing. I'm less willing as I get older. I think there's certain nice things that come with getting older, though our culture acts like it's all downhill. Mm-hmm. I think I'm less willing to be bored. I feel like, no, I do not want to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So I have picked my friends fairly carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't watch. I do enjoy it. I also, to my own surprise, I wasn't the type, I thought, whatever that meant. 2 years ago, I started a book club, book group. And... it's a number of writers and editors, and I enjoy it a lot.
Mm.
I like sort of sitting in my living room, serving up meatballs.
Well, and, I want to come to that.
You're invited.
Okay, I'm coming to New York. I want to come to Meatball Book Club, guys. Oh, I have so many questions for you, but this is a good one. Where does it hurt right now? I just wanted to share that my shoulders hurt. This part of my back hurts. This knee hurts. Everything hurts.
Many of those.
Where does it hurt? Do you feel the pain of depression? Still, remnants of it.
Yes, I think I do. I was with a very close friend of mine yesterday, and. Mm. Suddenly I like flipped from an okay mood to everything seeming very dark.
Mm.
And I couldn't quite tell what had caused it. But it was sort of like, there's some sense where I think there was a book critic for the Times years ago named Anatole Broillard, who was a very good friend of mine, and he always insisted that he made this big distinction that I wasn't a depressive meaning someone, I don't know what he meant by depressive, someone who slouched along grayly, you know, face down. But I feel it's very important to me to put, to hurl my wits at being a potential depressive.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels always like a possibility. I once wanted to start a novel with a doctor saying, tell me where it hurts.
Mm. Well, I'm glad I asked that question. My parent is a psychiatrist, so this is a little like therapy. I guess I'm supposed to pause from my own gigantic curiosity and offer the audience the opportunity to ask a few questions. There's a microphone coming around. Raise your hand.
So what do you think made your mother like she was?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Sorry. What did you think made your mother like she was? The issues that, you know, she, the way she acted towards you that you thought were problematic. What influenced her that she was like that? Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay.
I could go on for several years. I think she, if one goes by my oldest sister, who's a therapist, comes up with a very therapeutic and a very untherapeutic answer and announces that she thinks, she kept saying to me, did you make clear that Ma, we call her Ma, was evil? And I said, I don't know if I think she was evil. I think she was a woman with a lot of aggression in her. That maybe had she gone a different path, I don't think she was particularly meant to be a mother of six children. Mm. I'm not even sure she was meant to be a devoted, I mean, she wasn't a subservient wife particularly, but she certainly looked after my father. And I think she actually should have been something more formidable. That it was a lot of energy that didn't find an outlet. I don't know if that helps, partly.
Is this working? Yeah. I want to preface this by saying this is not coming from a place, how can you possibly be a good mother, but more from a very personal place. I was wondering how your depression has affected your relationship with your daughter.
Oh, I can't see who said... Oh, there you are. You'd probably have to ask my daughter for a fully candid answer to that. But I think I've tried... I certainly have tried to be a very different kind of mother than I was, than the way I was mothered. With its own drawbacks, for sure. And my daughter has also been exposed to my depression, which I feel guilt about and, you know, worried that it's a kind of modeling for how to respond to life. But she's a fairly resourceful and very independent-minded sort who has problems but doesn't seem that she's, you know, we're quite close. Some would argue we watched together Grey Gardens. And she began singing tea for two, which they sing to each other in Grey Gardens. And that we would end up like in Grey Gardens. I mean, she's 27, and she still lives with me, although she's had periods of dorming at Barnard, which she went to and dropped out of. And I don't know. I think it's played heavily that she feels too caretakery, which I do feel guilt about. But in many ways, I've tried to do things differently.
Well, that was my question, too. You know, mother of a daughter. But the other question that I was thinking about, you were talking about in 2001, which is when I was coming out of grad school for an MFA and really recognizing what was going on and read Noonday Demon and every other book that Louise mentioned, as well as some others, including one called Born Under Saturn. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something about the creativity and what people expect. I can't remember exactly what we were saying, but it was, there's a certain expectation among the creative peoples that we're all a little bit depressed. And then there's recognizing real depression, those of us who know it and medicate it and that sort of thing, but also the relationship of a different kind of mental wiring to even the very creative process. And we haven't talked at all about the creative process and what having a fundamentally different kind of brain chemistry and brain wiring possibly does for creativity. Like trying to, you know, I've always tried to find something out of this, you know, and right. I think that there's definitely a relationship to it. And I'd love to know what both of you, where you come at in that conversation.
Do you want to?
I'm like you. If I'm writing, I'm really happy. If I'm just sort of lost in the world of my script and living in the emotions of the people I'm writing about, and even when I'm not writing, I'm thinking about right. them or the project or the script. So it's sort of an antidepressant for me, really, to write. It creates just kind of another soul to, you know, to yeah. be in the souls of the other people. It's like having an affair,
right?
You know, when the writing is about something. So I don't know. I don't know. I'd love to hear your answer on that. Do you feel like it feeds?
I do. I'm of sort of two minds about it. I just read a book that I'm reviewing by Kay Jamison about Robert Lowell and his manic depression, which is very different from what's called unipolar depression. I mean, I've always thought I wouldn't mind a little manic moments in my life. I know it has its own downside, but people always talk about great bursts of creativity. I think in some ways, some of what goes along with the possibility of depression goes along with the possibility of creativity, which is having maybe less filters. That life comes in a little more sort of straight. And you don't, I don't mean you see more like a seer, but you take in things that people automatically filter out. I mean, I always love this quote from Freud, who unfashionably remains one of my heroes, who said, art exists to disturb the sleep of the world. And in some way, I think creativity in general exists to make people more conscious. So I think there is some connection.
I just wanted to ask about the death of your mom and about your Jewish faith and whether we didn't talk a lot about kind of Judaism and about where that fits into all of this and how your faith has helped you or unfortunately not enough, especially when your mom died and how you coped and whether that was a trigger for another depressive episode,
yeah.
but really about her death and about, you know, Judaism and has it helped you at all over the years in terms of the depression?
I was brought up Orthodox and, I once said to my mother, it was close to when she was near dying, and my mother struck me as the least, even though she was fully observant of the ritual of all, she struck me as the least pious of women. Other Orthodox people close to death have the rabbi of their synagogue come over and read them from Psalms or whatever they do. My mother wanted none of it. And I said to her, why did you keep it all? And she said to me, for the order. And I sometimes thought that I think I say in the book, I wonder guiltily, like, if I'd stayed observant, maybe I would have been less depressed because I would have been busy, I don't know, making a filter fish for Shabbos. I don't know. But I didn't stay observant, and I've never found, I feel very Jewish, and I still go on occasional searches for a synagogue that would appeal to me. But I can't say it's something that feels of enormous use in depression. And just to answer about my mother's death, I did get very depressed. I mean, not immediately, but 2 years after her death, I got what became this vegetative depression, and I think it was a lot about a million unresolved things.
Hi. I wonder what kinds of things you've experienced from people who love you over the years that have been helpful for you.
Good question. One thing, their love has been helpful. Their understanding. I think intimacy is enormously, that they know you, that they can, even the humor in very dark times. Comprehension, I think.
First of all, thank you for sharing. I know it can be tough. I guess partially into my question of, was it ever hard or were you ever afraid once you decided to write this book of going back to that feeling? Sometimes it's when you have been depressed and you kind of get to a lighter spot to have to delve back in to tell the story, particularly involving events with your mother. Was it almost hard to have to relive those?
Yes.
For the bigger purpose of the
say,
book.
Before you finish the question. No.
No, yeah.
I think one of the reasons the book took me so long was I was afraid of getting depressed writing about depression, and I did return to depression through some of the writing. So there was a certain sense that I wasn't protecting myself by writing about it.
Oh, can I just ask one more question from my card? It has nothing to do with depression, but it's something you said backstage, or we both said, that it's just funny. Just thought I'd lighten the mood. We both agreed that all men are homosexual.
I said until proven otherwise.
What did we mean by that?
Well, I actually was thinking about it because I was telling Jill that I had read a series of interviews with Margaret Duras, who wrote the novel The Lover, and she ended up, she had been married with a child, but she ended up living with a homosexual man. It sometimes seems like, you put it well, it seems sometimes that men don't enjoy the company of women, except on specified occasions, and that they really... What did we mean? I mean, I know what I mean.
Well, there's a homosocialness.
Yes.
To the sort of business of being masculine that, you know, sort of calls men to spend time with other men mostly, most of their day.
Right.
And then on the weekends,
and then
sports,
bond over
watching
football.
Sports. Yes.
Right.
They can't watch sports. They might be playing fantasy sports.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think we were talking about femininity, shame, pleasure, looking for happiness, and the sort of heterosexual, you know, Chris Krauss talks about it, and I love Dick, that her obsession over a man who truly can't love her, won't love her, and is a little bit disinterested in her, that kind of masochistic, abject obsession, gave birth to her voice. And gave birth, you know, in some ways was like almost a muse for her. It generated something, and yet it left her feeling very unseen and unknown and unintimate. And we talk about what right. what you get from the people who love you. They see you. They know you. They say, Daphne, you're a little like this, and yesterday you were like that.
Right.
And they get your, you know, is that something that a man is maybe incapable of? Sorry, not men. Heterosexual, I don't know. Am I just a new lesbian who's really excited?
And I'm a latent lesbian who is yet to get excited.
Just want to throw something out for the end of this that gives people something to bring home. Just get in an argument in the car.
Right. I don't know. I once wrote a piece, I was telling Jill, I wrote a piece years ago called I'm Not Becoming a Lesbian, in which I argued that in their second life, all women would be lesbians.
Yes, they'd I feel that over, way. I feel that way sometimes.
They get over the heterosexual. My daughter's always saying to me, but I might be a terrible model, whoever asked me that question, is always saying to me, but men and women don't really fit so well together. And there's a certain way in which it seems, I've always thought that women are socially, culturally forced to evolve more than men. Sorry if I'm sounding. And men get away with less personal, psychological evolution. It's less demanded of them in return. And in that way, I think and I don't know, I think men and women sort of almost like very different. I don't know how much most men, these are all horrendous generalizations. Mm-hmm. There's always that, like that men don't like these long, intimate, post-coital conversations, which women love. They just seem different.
First, I want to thank you for just the things you're saying, because it's kind of identical to what I've lived through. And so I have a moment of clarity that I'm not so crazy, because I'm hearing somebody else say the same thing. I have a daughter, single parent, but I've been on medication since I was 20, and I'm in my 70s now. And when you talked about going off of it, I don't know who I would be. So I'm terrified to even try that, because, you know, I'm happy being home alone, and, you know, I'm a painter and a writer and all that, so I have my own little world. But some days I just would like to just stop it. But it just terrifies me, because I would probably just sit in the house for the rest of my life.
I think it's I discovered by going off it in this
I was asking about the medication.
Untitrated way, that's certainly, they are potent, these chemicals, as I say in my book. Do they have any idea how they do what they do? No. Thus, there are a million possibilities. I think it takes, you need a lot of help going off them. That's my sense. If I would ever try again, which I'm not sure I will, but if I would, I would do it through some therapeutic mode.
Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome.
Microdoses of LSD.
Right.
Is what I've been hearing.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
So awesome.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.